To me, Beautyland is belief-shaped. It's a novel that is shaped by belief and shaped like belief. Either Adina is exactly who she believes she is, and you believe in Adina, or she is a troubled young woman into adult woman who suffers from a delusion.
Hello, and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the American West and beyond. The Right Question is supported in part by Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio, and by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. I'm Lauren Korn, speaking with Marie-Helene Bertino, author of Beautyland, a novel about the fragility and resilience of life on our Earth and in our universe. As a child, Adina Giorno recognizes that she is different. She possesses knowledge of a faraway planet. The arrival of a fax machine enables her to contact her extraterrestrial relatives, beings who have sent her to report on the oddities of Earthlings. Marie-Helene Bertino is the author of Beautyland, Parakeet, 2 a.m. at the Cat's Pajamas, and the story collection Safe as Houses. She was the 2017 Frank O'Connor International Short Story Fellow in Cork, Ireland. She has received the O. Henry Prize, the Pushcart Prize, the Iowa Short Fiction Award, the Mississippi Review Prize, and fellowships from McDowell, Sewanee, and New York City's Center for Fiction. Her work has twice been featured on NPR's Selected Shorts. She teaches creative writing at New York University and Yale University and lives in Brooklyn. Marie, thank you so much for being here. Welcome to The Right Question.
Thank you, Lauren. So happy to be here.
I want to begin our conversation in another book of yours, your collection of short stories, Safe as Houses. There's a story in that book titled, Sometimes You Break Their Hearts, Sometimes They Break Yours. And like in Beautyland, in this short story, an alien is observing human behavior. What was it about the alien at the heart of your short story that wouldn't allow you to walk away from her, that had you returning to her in Beautyland?
Well, I think it was that the alien in Sometimes You Break Their Hearts was launched directly from my fascination with human customs. And after I wrote the story and after it was published, that fascination did not abate. It was not satiated. So I began to keep a folder on my desktop called Notes on Human Beings, where I would collect these little glimmers of fascinations, like humans love fried eggs on everything, even pizza. Why? And why are the words de-thaw and thaw almost exactly the same? So I would collect these little details, and the folder grew and grew. And I wondered if I could make a novel from it. And so to do that, I would have to name the previously unnamed alien from the story and locate her and give her things like a family and background and memories and interests and likes and dislikes. And that became the really fun part. And by the fun part, I mean the part that was really hard work and took many, many years.
You named that alien Adina Giorno. She's the protagonist of Beautyland. And as you were speaking, Marie, I began thinking about how this book is kind of meta, because not only did you collect these pages of human behavior, Adina is doing the exact same thing.
She definitely continued the research that I began. And through her, I was able to do deeper dives into some of the topics in that folder. Yeah.
Adina's life, apart from her faxes to her extraterrestrial family, who you call in the book her quote-unquote superiors, and apart from the night school she attends while her human body sleeps, apart from this communication from Earth, Adina, from the outside, looks and acts mostly human. Save for her candor and honesty, she blends in fairly successfully on Earth. And this could be, depending on your reading of Beautyland, a bit of a trick question, but I'm wondering what makes Adina Giorno different from everyone else?
Well, I think that's the central preoccupation of the book. I think one of the questions that's running along the background is she that different from other human beings? If so, what makes a quote unquote typical human being? I think that's the rumination that comprises the gesture of the book. And to me, Beautyland is belief shaped. It's a novel that is shaped by belief and shaped like belief, because you can read it in two different ways. Either Adina is exactly who she believes she is, and you believe in Adina, or she is a troubled young woman into adult woman who suffers from a delusion. And if the reader begins to suspect that I deliberately set some of these sentences and scenes in certain orders and in certain ways to require their participation in solving this question and solving this equation, then that reader is absolutely correct. Because by the end of Beautyland, the reader, I hope, is contributing not only an important, but an absolutely crucial part to comprehending the story.
Even though I know authorial intention can be dismissed so easily once a book leaves the author's hands, I'm curious about where in the process of creating Adina and creating this story that intention took shape for you.
Sure. I also think, I absolutely agree that you can read the character in two different ways, like either she is or is not what she says she is. But also there is a third understanding that she, and perhaps this is the reader's comprehension, which is that she could be both human and extraterrestrial. And I think that would fall under believing in her, which are two different things as well. And when she does reveal her authentic self to those three different people throughout the book at different times and receives those three really disparate reactions, to me, that was an almost direct reflection of coming out narratives, coming out as who she actually is. I mean, she does happen to also be queer. I imagine her as somewhere on the asexual spectrum. And her friends are gay, Tony and Dominic. And it's not an accident that she is reflecting many times the process that people who come out to their families or their friends encounter. And so I wanted her to have three different reactions to kind of explore the different ways in which people who come out are received. And I couldn't, even though I wanted to, I couldn't make it as gentle for her because that wouldn't have been as realistic. So I tried to represent, you know, the reality of those situations.
Marie, I want to talk now about Carl Sagan and the Voyager 1 Golden Record, both of which meander throughout the narrative. But I'm wondering if you might be willing to read the first few sections of Beautyland, because I think the best way to introduce these ideas to our listeners might be to read from the book directly.
Yeah, first couple of pages, sure. Be happy to. In the beginning, there is Adina and her Earth mother. Adina, in utero, listening to the advancing yeses of her mother's heart, and her mother in the labor room, vitals plunging. Binary stars. Adina, swaying in zero gravity. Therese, fastened to the operating table. The monitor above the bed reports on their connected hearts, beating heart, heart, beating heart, beating. Therese's blood pressure plummets as Adina advances through the birth canal. She has almost reached Earth. At this moment, Voyager 1 spacecraft launches in Florida, containing a phonograph record of sounds intended to explain human life to intelligent extraterrestrials. It is September 1977, and Americans are obsessed with Star Wars, a Civil War movie set in space. Bounding to the stage after hearing her name, a Price is Right contestant loses her tube top and reveals herself to a shocked Burbank audience. In the labor room of Northeast Philadelphia Regional, no one notices Therese's plummeting blood pressure. Something lighter and more conscious detaches and slips beneath the body on the table, underneath the floor and sediment, landing in a corridor of waist-deep water. Behind her, an embodied darkness. Far in front, over an expanse of churning waves, a certain cherishing light. Therese wants that light more than she wants health, more than she wants this baby's father to become a shape that can hold a family. She forces one leg through the water, then the other, trying to paddle herself like a vessel. The contents of Voyager 1's record were chosen by Carl Sagan, a polarizing astronomer who wears natty turtleneck blazer combos and has been denied Harvard tenure for being too Hollywood. Carl and his team have assembled over 100 images depicting what they decided were typical Earth scenes: a woman holding groceries, an insect on a leaf. The sounds include Chuck Berry's Johnny Be Good, the sorrowful cries of humpback whales, and recordings of the brainwaves of Carl's third wife, footsteps, heartbeats, and laughter. Destinationless, Voyager 1 will travel 1.6 light years farther than any human-made object. At a press conference, Carl says that launching this bottle into the cosmic ocean is intended to tell the human story. The astronomers hoped to include the Beatles' Here Comes the Sun, but Columbia Records asked for too much money. It's hard to make human beings believe in things.
So Carl Sagan and the Golden Record are figures that Adina points to in her communication with her superiors throughout the novel, and they seem fairly uninterested in what she has to say about them. I'm curious about whether Carl Sagan, the Golden Record, were they figures that overwhelmed your own childhood imagination?
No, I'm sorry to say. I wish I could say yes. When I found out about the Voyager record, I was probably in my 20s, and it did capture my imagination, as I think it did for a lot of people, especially fans of music, to find out that these sounds were represented to tell the human story. I was very charmed by that. I found that to be incredibly romantic, and I still do. And with, you know, the wisdom of age, I think it's not only charming, but it's quaint to think that we can send a record out into deep space and have anything like a human pick it up and be able to listen to it or understand. So the cosmic bottle sent into space, I find to be really interesting. But I didn't know about Carl Sagan. I hadn't read and researched his work until this book. And it was in support of Adina and what she would have been fascinated by. When I did research him, I mean, I would get chills at some of his ideas. I mean, he was like a poet. He has this quote that I now cherish and have over my desk, which is, "If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe." And that to me is also reflects the journey of the creative process, and for sure, undertaking something that seems as impossible as writing a novel.
You're listening to A Conversation with novelist Marie-Helene Bertino. I'm Lauren Korn. This episode of The Right Question is supported by Montana Book Company, located in downtown Helena, Montana since 1978, offering new books for all ages, vinyl records, and community activism. For delivery in Helena and shipping online, visit mtbookco.com. I would love it, Marie, if you could talk about education or school in Beautyland. You focus on Adina's early education on Earth and the schooling she receives from her fellow aliens or superiors in the night classroom. This happens when she sleeps. It's such a large and dare I say, kind of magical or mystical part of the book. And I think school is so formative, right, in the ways that young children and young adults understand their relationship to others. Let's talk about education, especially as you've kind of navigated it for or through Adina in the book.
I think that's really apt. School does matter a lot in Beautyland, both in her daytime human life, and then when she goes to sleep and wakes to find herself in what is called the night classroom, when her superiors are teaching her or supplementing essentially her earth education, which is kind of like the two different sides of nature and nurture too. School was always important to me because it was where I could be myself, and it was where my efforts seemed to be rewarded in ways I could understand. And I think that I lent that to the character of Adina. And it's also a place where we go to be socialized with people who have come from their own cultures and families. And we kind of test ourselves against them. And in doing so, we learn who we are even more. So it was great fun to write the school scenes, especially the grade school scenes in Northeast Philadelphia, which is where she grows up and which is where I grew up. Because it's also very fun to write students, like young students, learning from teachers and baffling those teachers in certain ways. So yeah, school has always been important to me. And I guess it follows that it's very important to Adina too.
Marie, something that I hadn't considered until you said it was that school was a place for you where you could be your true self, where you were comparing your true self and butting that self up against the true selves of other peers. And I don't know that I would ever have considered school the place where I was my true self. I can't say definitively that that's not the case, just because there is such a performative aspect of school, right? When you're comparing your growing self, your shifting self, your not static self with your peers and their shifting selves, right? So you're comparing shifting selves. I just don't know that I'd ever say that would be a true self, but perhaps it is part of a true self. I don't know. Can you expand on that idea or your own experience a little bit more?
I think that a lot of people would agree with you. And I certainly have friends who not only did not like school, but dropped out of school and did their own and made their own really great ways because they hated being in classrooms. But so, for some of us, the classroom is by far so preferable to what we were dealing with at home that absolutely all of the comparisons, and especially I grew up as a little girl, comparing yourself to others, all of that was in place too. But what I loved about school is that they left me alone with the blank page a lot. And there would be whole class periods dedicated to reading, which is all I wanted to ever do anyway. And then we would have these things called spelling tests where we got to spell words on a blank page. And if we were lucky, if the teacher was feeling sassy that day, she would then allow us to choose five of those words and make them into sentences at the bottom of the page. And then I was just in heaven. And it was in the sixth grade, actually, when we, during one of those spelling tests, when my teacher, Mrs. Altamari, was sitting and grading the tests at her desk while we worked in quiet, that she announced to the whole class, she called my name and she said, "Have you ever thought of becoming a writer?" And of course I had. I had since I had conscious memory, but I wanted to play it cool. So I was like, "Oh, I don't even think I answered." And she said, "Because I really think that you should be a writer." And in Northeast Philadelphia, that was tantamount to setting an entire table on fire. Like no one, that was just so unheard of. And it meant that was the first person who ever told me that I should do something like that, or even that something like that was possible. So I could be quiet and I could still be seen in school. And Mrs. Altamari, I borrowed her last name for the protagonist of my debut novel, 2 a.m. at the Cat's Pajamas. And the main little girl in that book is Madeline Altomare, after that teacher. Yeah, school was where I got to hear nice things.
I love that story so much. Shout out to Mrs. Altomare and to all the teachers who tell their students to keep going. I'm going to pivot, if that's okay. Mm-hmm. Marie, you seem preoccupied with or interested in the idea of a character, a person, being able to change their own circumstance. You certainly did this in Parakeet. Is this something that you are intentionally considering and diving into when crafting narrative? Or, I don't know, maybe this is something that all fiction has, so maybe it's not necessarily a consideration specific to Beautyland. How do you see that idea of your protagonists, your characters, being able to and taking control of, taking agency of changing their circumstances?
I'm just thinking of how metamorphosis is kind of baked into speculative fiction. I mean, one of the most famous stories in that realm is The Metamorphosis, where a man wakes up having changed in the night into a dung beetle. And the whole story is about him trying to get to work. I think speculative narratives have always appealed to me because they are kind of acts of survival by people who do wish to move out of their own circumstances, in some cases, escape their own circumstances and get to more favorable circumstances, sometimes circumstances in which they are no longer under threat. And so like things like Afrofuturism, for example, like even like imagining a future is radical and speculative for some cultures. And it has always appealed to me. That's one of the reasons it's always appealed to me. I've always liked it because it allowed for people who are lower income. It allowed for people who work, people whose lives are determined by how hard they can work. And that's the world I grew up in. And so it was nice that that table allowed for us in ways that I didn't always feel in more straight ahead mainstream literary fiction. I didn't feel like I had access to the worlds that I was reading about, where, like, for example, Jane Austen, you know, the opulent, wonderful, affluent, lovely world of hours long dinners in the parlor, et cetera, et cetera. That to me is more speculative than anything I write, because it's more out of reach and it seems more fantastical than a little girl who feels like she's faxing home in her bedroom.
I feel like class is such an important part of this book. Adina's own investigations into class are inextricably linked with family and her relationship to and how she thinks about her mother. So I don't want to move on from it just yet, but I don't have a specific question for you. Is there anything else you'd want to talk about as it relates to class in the novel?
I'd be happy to, because it is something that's very important to the novel and to me. It was the most direct I've been in fiction toward, you know, the way that I have actually experienced class go down in my life. And it's baked into all of the small events in our lives, what I would call the profound mundane. It's baked into all of that. And I think that's what Adina was trying to say. In the beginning of Beautyland, she and her mom are in the store, and she knows that her mom won't buy the bigger version of her perfume that is a more economical buy, because even though it's more economical, she wouldn't be able to afford that. She just plain wouldn't be able to afford that, because she says they couldn't afford to be good with money. And I think unless you grow up with no money, that kind of logic is not going to make sense. And I've had people try to explain things like that to me, like, Marie, just buy this bigger, better thing and it'll save you more money in the long run. And it's like, oh, well, I didn't grow up with more money to do things like that. And so when I realized that not everybody understood that kind of skewed logic, I realized that I wanted to put it in Beautyland and see if it would work. So long story short, too late. Adina writes a 2-page transmission about class where she lists all of these little micro things about class. And then her superiors write back, "We get it," because she's gone on and on. And I was happy that FSG and my editor, Jenna Johnson, allowed me to keep that in.
Marie, I have one more question for you. How did writing the character and telling the story of Adina change you?
Am I allowed to say that it was because of changes I had already gone through that I was even able to write Beautyland? Almost as if Beautyland was the result and not the cause of change. I feel grateful to be able to say that. And it's also a little sad because I had to lose a lot of people to gain the insight that I think Beautyland hopefully is trying to show and have. But it's finding its readers. And I think that I hope that the conversations I go on to have with readers will change me. I have a feeling. I put this work into the world because I had encountered some really profound loss. And there was something I wanted to say not only about that, but about what I remembered about growing up, that loss emboldened me to finally try to articulate. And my theory, I'm crossing my fingers, is that the more honest I could be about that, and the more I could drill down into things that I had never before felt strong enough to write about, like being Italian American, coming from a lower income, being queer, being on the asexual spectrum, things about profound disability and autism and neuroatypicalness, all of those things. The more I drilled down into the specifics of that, I hope it would reach more people. Seemingly counterintuitively, I hoped it would be more universal. And so far, I'm shocked by the variety of people who relate to Adina. And I hope I get to meet them and hear their stories. And I hope that I will then be changed.
Marie, thank you so much for spending some time with me today. And thank you so much for Beautyland.
It's my pleasure, Lauren. Thank you for having me.
That was Marie Helene Bertino, author of Beautyland, out now from Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. Look for more information about Marie at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook and Instagram. You've been listening to The Right Question. This episode was produced by Chris Moyles and me. I'm your host, Lauren Korn. The artwork for The Right Question was designed by Molly Russell, and our music was written and recorded by John Floridis. Funding for The Right Question is provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting this program since 2008, and thank you for listening. The Right Question is a production of Montana Public Radio.